and a good Thursday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, X, and Facebook. Don't forget that you can take the show with you on demand on your own time by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Our show this morning is brought to you in part by The Law Group. Visit them online at lawgroupnc.com or give them a call at 910-251-6088. We are going to start off this morning taking a look at the Atlantic hurricane season as we continue to watch the tropics this morning as Tropical Storm Aaron does continue with its push towards the west. This is something that has been talked about over the last couple of days, and we are going to keep an eye on that this morning. Here is the latest information out of this storm, a Tropical Storm Aaron still working its way west. Movement due west still at 17 miles an hour, a little bit slow than when we were together yesterday morning. Winds up a little bit now, 50 miles an hour. Pressure sitting at 1,002 millibars. As that pressure gets lower, that means that the storm is in fact getting stronger. Here is the latest forecast out of the National Hurricane Center. They're based in Miami, Florida, showing that Aaron is set to become a hurricane sometime between Friday and Saturday, likely Friday afternoon, likely sometime between Friday morning and Friday afternoon into maybe early Saturday, when that would transition from a tropical storm to a hurricane. And projections still have this becoming a major hurricane. Now, what a lot of the conversation over the last couple of days, at least since the early part of the week, has been this northward turn in the storm. And the question remains, will this immediately impact the eastern seaboard, and of course, especially here across southeastern North Carolina? That remains relatively uncertain this morning. And as we look back at the stats and look at what the National Hurricane Center is saying, they are even admitting, and I say admitting like they're hiding something, but they even put out in their public message as of 5 o'clock this morning, while there is still uncertainty in what the impacts might occur in the portions of the Bahamas, the east coast of the United States, and Bermuda next week, the risk of dangerous surf and rip currents across the western Atlantic basin next week is increasing. So as we look at that, no question about it, regardless of whether this storm has any direct or immediate impact on southeastern North Carolina from a rain and wind standpoint, the ripped current is going to be highly elevated as we get into the middle and latter parts of next week, a week or so from right now. And what we've seen over the last couple of days is the models continuing to show this storm a couple hundred miles off the coast and curving out to sea. However, over the last probably 24 hours or so, we have seen some models inch this storm ever closer to the United States coastline. That is being showed pretty well here in the European model, which is known as one of the better hurricane models, and we'll play it out for you. And, you know, it's important, as I talked about earlier this week, when you're looking at tropical systems and tropical weather, you don't look at one individual model run and say, oh, this is gospel, this is what's going to happen. You look at the trends, and especially from the European model, which tends to do a better job with hurricanes than many other models, we have seen a trend over the last 24 hours of a storm getting much further west. And you can see in this most recent model run, it shows the storm just right off the North Carolina coast, likely causing some wind and rain in our area. This is showing a picture for 2 p.m. on August 20th, which would be next Wednesday, when we could be looking at something like this. So that trend is a little bit further to the west, still not showing a landfall here across southeastern North Carolina. I don't believe there's any reason for folks to be scrambling this morning to go out and prepare for a major landfalling hurricane. There's no indication, at least as of right now, that that is going to happen. But I bring it up this morning and I lead off the show with it because, as I mentioned Monday or Tuesday when we talked about this storm, we're keeping an eye on the trends. For the early part of this week, the trend was out to sea further east, no real impacts except for some elevated surf and rip current risks here on the East Coast. However, over these last two European model runs, we are seeing that trend coming closer to the coast here in southeastern North Carolina. This model's one that ran yesterday. You can see it coming very close to the Outer Banks area. So that is what we are going to be watching throughout the remainder of today and into the weekend is, does this westward trend continue and put something like Wilmington and southeastern North Carolina in the bullseye, or are these just some bad runs and everything coalesces back to the east, and we look at the storm splitting that gap between the continental United States and Bermuda. And, you know, looking at some of the modeling runs, you can see that this northward turn is going to happen. Here is what is known as the spaghetti model plot from all of the major hurricane models. And you can definitely see that northward turn is going to happen. The question is, when does it happen? Where does it happen? And how close can this storm system get to the East Coast before that inevitable turnout to sea, which it does appear it's going to turn out to sea. There's really nothing showing that this thing is going to plow through North Carolina, South Carolina, or really anywhere on the East Coast. The question is, could this storm skirt either here in southeastern North Carolina, the Outer Banks area, and what could some of those impacts look like? So that is what we are keeping an eye on this morning with Tropical Storm Aaron, again, continuing to strengthen at least a little bit this morning as those winds are now up to 52 miles an hour. And as we look at the intensity forecast, you can see this storm is very much expected to be a very strong hurricane. Many of the hurricane models have it well within the Category 3, a lot flirting, some in the Category 4 range, which would be winds above 115 miles an hour, being a very strong Category 3, low-end Category 4 hurricane, as this is expected to be the first major declaration of a storm for the 2025 Atlantic hurricane season. That's the latest. No reason to panic. No reason to begin boarding up your house or anything like that this morning. Again, keeping an eye on the trends, seeing how this continues to progress over the next probably 48 to 72 hours. By Saturday or Sunday, we should have a pretty good idea what this thing is going to do, because, if we look at the forecast track from the National Hurricane Center, by Saturday or Sunday, we'll know whether that northward movement has really started or not, and those models should hopefully have a pretty good job at projecting its path. It's still kind of waning as a tropical storm. It was earlier this week, it looked like it could be a tropical storm by Wednesday. That has not materialized. The storm has continued to drift a little bit further west. And as we get out, the Hurricane Center only projects out about 5 days. You can see that 2 a.m. Tuesday designation here on their official chart. So as we get into Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday of next week, that five-day cone will encompass pretty much where we're expecting the center of that storm to go as we head into the middle and latter parts of next week. Something to keep an eye on throughout the weekend. We'll look at it again tomorrow morning as well on our Friday edition to see whether those trends have consisted with the storm moving further to the west, or if that was just maybe a couple of bad model runs from the European model. And even looking outside of the European model, which I think typically does a pretty good job, even with the GFS system, while it does still show the storm pretty clearly going out to sea, it is definitely further west than we had seen in a couple of days past, even completely splitting that gap between the United States and Bermuda. So that is ongoing right now. This model is actually running as we speak, so you can see kind of what that track, at least according to one run of the GFS, looks like, showing that storm system being at this point probably, I don't know, maybe 250, 300 miles off the coast of North Carolina. Something that we'll watch throughout the day, and we'll keep an eye on it right here on the Nick Craig Show. A lot going on, of course. President Donald Trump set to meet with Vladimir Putin tomorrow. I just saw this before we came on the air. That meeting is set to happen at 3:30 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow. In Alaska, time zone change and difference, but around 3:30 Eastern time is when that meeting is supposed to take place. We may or may not do some sort of additional bonus show sometime late tomorrow afternoon or maybe Saturday morning, depending on what comes out of that meeting. So stay tuned to our Rumble, YouTube, Facebook, and X accounts for all of that as we head into the weekend. We'll really break down tomorrow morning. We'll do a deep dive into the precursor of this meeting, what things are looking like and how things are set to play out as the president continues to ratchet up the pressure on Russian President Vladimir Putin ahead of that meeting. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will not be there, so he's not going to be in attendance. We'll kind of run through all of that tomorrow morning as a little bit of a preview as to what we can expect coming out of that meeting. Again, as it stands right now, set to take place around 3:30 Eastern time on Friday. All eyes, literally, across the entire world will be have their eyes on the great state of Alaska, seeing what comes out of that meeting between Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. We talk a lot about what's going on in Washington, D.C., and it's always great when we can bring Washington, D.C. to the airwaves here across southeastern North Carolina. To help us with that this morning, it's my pleasure to welcome Congressman David Rauser back to the Nick Craig Show this morning. Congressman Rauser, appreciate the time as we sit here in the middle of August. The Atlantic hurricane season is getting towards its peak, which happens around the middle of September. You've got some information on your website. You know, a lot of new folks moving to southeastern North Carolina over the last couple of years. Many of them may have never dealt with a hurricane before. How important is hurricane preparedness from your perspective up in Washington?
Well, it's really important, and you alluded to the link on our website, which you can access by going to rauser.house.gov. A lot of to-dos and then a few don'ts on there as well on that web page. But the main thing is to have a plan, have contingencies in place so that you know what to do when you're presented with a natural disaster coming your way. And the main thing is listen to the local officials and do what they tell you to do. If they say get out of town, get out of town. Don't assume that you're going to survive it, because there's a reason why those public admonitions are put in place to begin with. They want to save lives. And if I can mention one other thing, that if you don't remember anything with regard to hurricane preparedness, do remember this. Almost all of the tragic fatalities, you know, where folks die in a storm is when they're going through running water. They're trying to drive through running water. Probably not 98% of deaths during a hurricane are from that, where folks, you know, try to take the chance. And what you don't know is what's below the surface there. It may be a road that's washed out, and it doesn't take a whole lot of water to pick up most vehicles and cart them right on downstream. And that is a very, very scary proposition that really does put your life in danger. So, the old saying, you know, when you come to, you know, a significant amount of water, don't drive, you know, save your life and turn back around.
Yeah. Turn around, don't drown. That's the phrasing there out of the National Weather Service. And as you point out, something like 4 to 6 inches of rushing water can sweep an SUV off the road, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but when it gets moving, it can be pretty detrimental. Turning our attention back to Washington this morning, the One Big Beautiful Bill signed into law a little over a month ago. Since then, Congressman Rauser, the folks on the left-wing side of the political aisle, the mainstream media outlets across the country have had a lot of fun at the Republicans' expense, pointing at the Big Beautiful Bill as a big failure. Give us your thoughts. We haven't had a chance to chat since that was passed. You voted in favor of that legislation. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was a monumental package. Had a little bit of everything in there all across the board as it relates to making America energy dominant again. It was made the tax provisions that were set to expire at the end of the year from the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act. It made those permanent. Everybody in North Carolina 7, the 7th Congressional District, was going to face a pretty significant tax increase if we didn't get this package passed, because, again, all those tax cuts that were put into place in 2017 were set to expire, many of which were very, very important to small business. In fact, had we not gotten this passed, small business would end up paying 43% in taxes. And so that really would have been devastating to the economy, not just nationally, obviously, but locally. The vast majority of your jobs are created by small business. And then, of course, one of the fundamental issues that we have to tackle is the growing national debt. And I want to talk about that just a little bit in the construct of the Big Beautiful Bill. The fact of the matter is, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017, it actually increased revenue to the Treasury. It did not decrease revenue into the Treasury. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office was off by about 1.5 trillion. They said it was going to run a deficit of 1.5 trillion. The tax cuts basically were going to drain the coffers of the Treasury by 1.5 trillion. And what actually happened was that the coffers were improved by 1.5 to 1.7 trillion. So looking at it from that perspective, the CBO was about $3 trillion off. And so that's hardly accurate. Secondly, the items that really drive the national debt, it's not taxes, it's not tax cuts, rather. What drives the national debt is our aging population. It's increasing cost of health care. And it's what are referred to as entitlement programs, also known as mandatory spending programs, which are predominantly Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And so we have to grapple with those because that's roughly two-thirds of the total federal budget. And to put in perspective, when we vote on annual appropriations bills, what sometimes are referred to as a big omnibus package, that only covers about 22 to 25, 26% of the total federal budget. You could wipe all that out, and if you never make any adjustments to the mandatory spending programs of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid predominantly, then you're never ever going to get a handle on the debt. You don't even scratch the surface. Even if you get rid of the 30, or pardon me, the 25, 26% that's discretionary spending, which, by the way, more than 50% of that is Homeland Security, border security, and national defense. Not exactly things that the vast majority of Americans want to cut. So that's important to understand. In the realm of Medicaid, which is what the Big Beautiful Bill really was focused on the spending side anyway, Medicaid, you have a tremendous amount of waste, fraud, and abuse. And even outside of the waste, fraud, and abuse category, you have 4.8 million people that are able-bodied adults, have no dependents, that are perfectly capable of working, but who are not working. And I think most people would agree that if you work, you ought to be better off than if you don't work. And so we work really hard in this package to reform the Medicaid program by putting in place work requirements for those, again, who are able-bodied, have no dependents, meaning no children, and who are perfectly capable of working. Again, that's 4.8 million people. You'd cut that just in half, and you save a pretty significant amount of money. One other thing I want to mention is you've got 1.6 million that are improperly enrolled in more than one state. So they're not only, say, for example, improperly enrolled in Medicaid in North Carolina, they're improperly enrolled in Kentucky or Tennessee or or any other state. And so that adds to the expense. You've got $13 billion a year that we've identified in erroneous payments for Medicaid. So again, there's a lot of things that need to be shored up. But the fundamental problem with Medicaid is, like with so many other government programs, once we got out of COVID, you had all these extension of programs and all this extra money put in place for the SNAP program, which is basically food stamps for Medicaid, et cetera. You had states that expanded eligibility for Medicaid, and North Carolina is one of them. But what basically happened is all the safeguards that had traditionally been in place, all those safeguards got waived, and so therefore, it opened up the door for that much more fraud and abuse, which has driven up the spending And so I think that's quite important to understand. And then if you look over the last 20 years in particular, 25 years in particular, there are three big drivers of the debt. One is 9/11. When we had the terrorist attack on 9/11, obviously a number of different industries were impacted. The airline industry, for example, Congress passed a jobs and stimulus package at that time. So, in other words, we were pumping money out the door. And keep in mind, 9/11 was when we were actually starting to run a surplus. And the reason why we were running a surplus was you had a lot more money coming into the Treasury due to the vast expansion of the economy, largely because of the Reagan policies of the 80s and the deregulatory efforts. And then you had a drawdown of defense spending. The world was at peace, well, at least prior to 9/11 anyway. The world was at peace. You had the BRAC in place, the base reduction and alignment closure of various bases around the country. So we weren't having to spend as much money on defense, which is a huge line item in the budget. And for that reason, and for those reasons, you were starting to see a surplus. Well, 9/11 happens, and we're spending more money. The next big crisis of 2008, what was it? The financial crisis.
Sure.
Well, we end up spending a lot of money to get through that. And then the humdinger of them all was when we shut down the economy to deal with COVID. And that's when the deficit and the debt really expanded dramatically. So those three major events is basically the reason why today we're facing a $37 trillion debt. The other reason is the aging population. When you have an aging population, you have more folks getting on Social Security and Medicare, and it's healthcare cost that really drive the debt through Medicaid, Medicare, and then also Obamacare, the subsidy premiums.
Congressman
So
Rouse.
I think that's important to understand. And we were focused predominantly with the Big Beautiful Bill on the Medicaid component, particularly getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse.
Congressman Rouser, I've heard you talk about this discretionary side or this mandatory side of spending before. I've heard you mention it in town hall meetings. When you've joined me on the radio in the past, we've talked about it. Is that not, though, an issue for Republican politicians to deal with? Because many think of it as a poison pill. You bring up the idea of changing some of these entitlement programs that you lay out. You talk about Social Security, you talk about Medicare, Medicaid, and SNAP. And the concept is you talk about these issues, Congressman Rouser, and you're going to turn off a whole bunch of your voting bloc. How do you base the crisis that we're dealing with, $37 trillion in debt, and the very unpopular political opinion that it is to cut some of these programs? It seems like it's almost unsustainable.
Well, I think most people would agree you don't need waste, fraud, and abuse in these programs, and you got a whole lot of it. So our focus is on getting rid of the waste, fraud, and abuse. And when you make these modifications, you're not aiming and you're not cutting individual benefits, particularly for those who are on the programs. And that's an important distinction to make. But if you don't make modifications to preserve these programs long term, 2035 and 2036, pretty much Medicare and Medicaid are totally completely bankrupt, and Social Security is not too far behind that. If you want to have these programs long term, you have to make common sense modifications, ahead of time. And that's the whole point. You can't balance the books just with revenue. And you can't balance the books just with spending cuts. You've got to do both. You got to be growing the economy at 3.5 to 4% GDP, which the deregulatory efforts of the Trump administration are significantly help with that. Making the tax cuts permanent helps with that tremendously because you got that much more economic activity, which means you have more money coming into the Treasury. And then just cutting out the waste, fraud, and abuse out of Medicare and Medicaid, for example, just those two programs, and then add the third SNAP, what many people know as food stamps, that saves a whole lot of money. And that savings can go towards shoring up those programs long term. I think every American, when they understand that and understand the challenges that we face from a budgetary standpoint, I don't know anybody out there that agrees with fraud, waste, and abuse, except for those who are involved in the fraud, waste, and abuse.
No question about it. You mentioned briefly some of the regulatory environment and deregulation. I think one of the unsung heroes of this second Trump administration, Congressman Rauser, has been Lee Zeldin over at EPA. I know that environmental issues are, of course, incredibly relevant to you in the 7th Congressional District. Not only do you have the expansive coastline, but you've got farming and rivers and streams that run all through the Congressional District. Lee Zeldin has really done a phenomenal job on dealing with some of these overburdensome federal regulations that make it damn near impossible to do anything when it came to things before with EPA.
Well, absolutely. And I've told people forever that, if we were trying to put in place the interstate highway system today, you couldn't do it. The rules and regulations would prevent you from laying any asphalt. And so that's a really, really important point. You can have good environmental standards in place without without impeding economic development, economic activity. And that's really important to understand. You got to have a balance.
Absolutely. We're seeing that now, fortunately, out of the EPA. Congressman Rauser, you keep folks up to date on your website with a variety of press releases and your very popular newsletter, which is received coast to coast and probably worldwide. Where can folks go and sign up for that and get some more details from you and your team?
Certainly, rouser.house.gov is the website. That'll give you a link to just about every social avenue that that we have. And of course, we'll provide the link to sign up for the newsletter, which you're correct is pretty popular. There are not many places I go where I don't have somebody come up to me and say, "I love your newsletter," and I've never met the individual before. And sometimes it's been out of state even. And I ask them, I say, "Well, how do you get this out here in Dallas, Texas, or Orange County, California?" And they say, "Oh, I got a cousin that lives in your district or is in North Carolina," and so. North Carolina has tentacles all over the country. I have learned that.
Congressman Rauser, we appreciate the time this morning. Thanks for joining me on the Nick Craig Show.
Great to be with you.
Always a great conversation there with Congressman David Rauser. Appreciate him and his team for coming and joining us here on the show and bringing the Capitol again. We talk a lot about what's going on in Washington, D.C., bringing that down here to the folks in southeastern North Carolina. Appreciate his work and his team's work making that happen pretty regularly here on the Nick Craig Show. We've got a lot more to get into this morning, but before that, I do want to tell you about one of our great sponsors here, The Law Group, here in Wilmington. And I want to let you know that when legal challenges arise, it's unfortunate, but sometimes they do. Make sure you put your trust in The Law Group right here in Wilmington. Since 2003, their experienced attorneys have provided high-quality, affordable legal services across the eastern half of our state. Whether you're facing a divorce, navigating real estate transactions, or maybe you're in a position where you need a strong criminal defense, the Law Group has your back. Their dedicated team ensures your questions are answered and issues are resolved as quickly as possible. Some great news for you. They are located in downtown Wilmington and just a phone call away at 910-251-6088, or you can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com. Give them a call. 910-251-6088 or their website lawgroupnc.com. The Law Group, experience and dedication you can rely on. We appreciate the Law Group and their continued support of the Nick Craig Show. Well, we know that statistics, specifically those that come out of the federal government, often draw a high level of scrutiny. And now that President Donald Trump is shaking things up at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the left-wing media and progressives are beside themselves. Yet they were completely silent when this was going on during the Joe Biden administration. We'll get into some of those details as we roll on this Thursday morning, streaming live on YouTube, Rumble, X, Facebook, and 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. And a good Thursday morning to you. Welcome back to the Nick Craig Show. Thanks for spending some time with us here this morning. So you got to give the Democrats a little bit of heat when you find out and you consistently see their incredible level of hypocrisy. And I'm turning this morning to an article I caught over at the Financial Times and some commentary that I've seen across mainstream media over the last couple of days. This is the headline over at the Financial Times. Quote, "The world is not going to trust our data. Trump's BLS, that's the Bureau of Labor Statistics pick, sparks alarm." Okay. I mean, it's a pretty serious accusation, a pretty serious headline. The world's not going to trust our data. That should be something that is, well, rather concerning. If you've got data that is being, quote unquote, manipulated from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So let's read through a little bit of this article and then point to some situations that have unfolded in the past where there's been zero media attention or coverage. So reading directly from the Financial Times, Donald Trump's stacking of the Bureau of Labor Statistics boss after a grim jobs report earlier this month sparked investor fears that he was putting politicians in the world's most closely watched economic data. Trump's pick to lead BLS, E.J. Antony, a fierce loyalist and cheerleader for the president's tariffs and economic strategy, has only deepened the anxiety. According to Stan Verger, a senior fellow at the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute think tank, says, quote, "The hope was that he would pick someone who people would have trust in and could lead the Bureau of Labor Statistics in an appropriate way, with relevant experience and ideally not a hyper-partisan. However, his pick is really the opposite of that. Even the people who may be somewhat sympathetic to his economic policy views don't think that he is qualified." So this article goes into an entire diatribe about how this guy that Trump picked to lead BLS is nothing more than a Trump loyalist and the data can't be trusted. And I started thinking to myself, back during the Biden administration, I remember, of course, many of you following me on the radio here in Wilmington, almost once a month, if not more, we chatted with economist, and he's been on the Nick Craig Show as well, economist Dr. Vance Ginn. And we've chatted with him over a variety of issues. Predominantly, it was during Federal Reserve meetings. He joined us to talk about that, general reports on the economy. He was a pretty regular guest on the show throughout the last year or so and was constantly talking about revised numbers. So I went digging yesterday to see if I could find out exactly what was being talked about, and I came across this article from August of last year, August 23rd of 2024. So this article is almost a year old. And this is a headline over at the Daily Caller, and it reads as follows. "One in three jobs that the Biden administration announced over the course of a year didn't actually exist, according to revised reports." And so this is the details. Over a third of the more than 3 million jobs the Biden administration announced were added in initial reports between April 2023 and March 2024 didn't actually exist. That's according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. This is while Joe Biden was still in office, August of last year. Including monthly revisions, the Biden administration overstated the number of jobs in the U.S. economy by a whopping 1.18 million in the year through March, accounting for approximately 36% of the 3.24 million jobs initially claimed. That's according to data from the BLS calculated by the Daily Caller News Foundation. This massive revision, along with the disappointing July jobs report last year, showed that the U.S. economy added 61,000 fewer non-farm payroll jobs than economists anticipated, and it has heightened fears of a recession. In this, the irony of all of this is hilarious. So the article over here at the Daily Caller cites a tweet from now the individual who is leading the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And at the time he posts this chart, he put this on Twitter last year, August 21st, 2024, and he writes this. "Don't forget that today's massive downward benchmark revision, the second largest on record, is on top of the existing downward revisions to the initial monthly jobs report figures. between all of the revisions, job growth for the 12-month period is wildly overestimated by almost 1.2 million jobs. So this was happening and was a very regular occurrence during the Biden administration. They were cooking the books in favor of better job numbers on the initial report. So every month you get a jobs report for the month prior. And so what you saw month over month, year over year during the Biden administration was they would come out and say something like, we created 300,000 new jobs in the month of September. Just use that as an example. That's not an actual number and that's not the actual month, but this is how it would work. They'd say we created 300,000 new jobs in September. That jobs report would come out in the month of October. It lags behind by a month. So then the October jobs report comes out in November and they say, oh, bury it in the report and say, oh, hey, for the month before, we didn't actually create 300,000 new jobs. We only created 100,000 new jobs. So we're going to revise that number by 200,000. But that's buried in the next month's job report as they go through and revise the number. And what this chart shows, what this chart shows here, and I'll pull it up again, is that these jobs report numbers were wildly overstated. And you can see these red lines are showing the revised job reports, and you can see all of the red. This is showing a calendar from April of 2023 to March of 2024, and outside of 3 months where the numbers were slightly up, you were talking about thousands, tens of thousands of jobs that were overreported in the initial BLS report. Now, I'm going to argue and make the point that manipulating data on either side of the political aisle is bad. If the Biden administration does it, it's bad. If the Trump administration does it, it is also bad. But you're going to have to spare me your outrage, like this ridiculous article over at the Financial Times. You're going to have to spare me your outrage that you care at all about these numbers being overreported or underreported by the new guy as the head of AJ, the new head of BLS. Because you guys sat on your hands, watched this unfold month after month, year after year during the Biden administration, and didn't say a word. The only people reporting it were, of course, Fox News, Newsmax, OAN. It was prominent on social media. Places like the Daily Caller reported it. There was no mainstream coverage of this. You didn't turn on CNN. You didn't turn on MSNBC, and they had experts on saying, well, you know, these Biden administration job numbers that have been revised month after month after month are really problematic, and we should begin taking a look into the Bureau of Labor Statistics and see what is going on with these numbers. Why are there so many downward revisions? And when we look at particularly the revision that took place in August of last year, it is the second largest revision in the history of BLS's labor statistics. The second largest overall. These reports, again, come out 12 times a year. Every single month, there's a BLS report on jobs. And so this is just another example this morning of so-called outrage from those on the political left that had nothing to say when this was happening during the Biden administration. And so, again, my point is very clear. Manipulating data is bad, but I'm not going to sit here and try and wrap myself around in a pretzel to try and justify how it was okay for Joe Biden and his administration to do it, but it's bad for Trump to do it. See, those on the political left loved that those numbers were being cooked by the Bureau of Labor Statistics during Joe Biden. They loved the fact that it looked like every single month these great jobs numbers were coming out when it was all fictitious. I don't have any other way to describe it except for the numbers were bullshit, plain and simple. Because you'd find out a month, two, 3 months later that the so-called 300,000 jobs that were created wasn't even close. And as is reported here by the Daily Caller last year, they overestimated jobs by more than almost 1.2 million in the span of a year. This is not some sort of minor miscalculation. This is almost 40% of the jobs that they said were created were not. I don't remember hearing a whole lot about that. Do you? I remember talking about it on the radio. I remember economist Dr. Vance Ginn joining me, and he'll join us coming up here in the next couple of weeks. We'll talk about what's going on in the economy. I remember him talking about it. I remember seeing people on Fox Business like Maria Bartiromo and other folks. I remember them talking about it. But I don't remember a Financial Times article about it. I don't remember CNN and MSNBC, which they've been doing over the last couple of days, talking about how the new head of BLS is nothing more than a right-wing extremist, and he's a product of the Heritage Foundation, Project 2025, so on and so forth. I don't remember any of that going on in the past. And the reason I don't remember it is because it, well, didn't happen. The Democrats didn't care that the jobs reports were wildly inflated under the Biden administration. They didn't care that BLS at the time was cooking the books. There's no other way to describe an almost 40% error rate in your labor statistics other than you are purposefully misleading the public, purposefully misleading the American consumers and generally the world economy with these numbers. You don't have a 40% error rate. And if you do, well, then you probably need to completely change the way in which you do your statistics. There's no way that the BLS, who again is responsible for doing this month after month, year after year, has a 40% error rate in their calculation. If they do, there's no point of having a BLS. If you have a 40% error rate, why are we even wasting our time with this? Who cares what the data looks like if you have a 40% error rate? That's absurd. But the left didn't care. But mainstream media didn't care. Democrats didn't care. And now these individuals want to sit on their high horse, preach from the top of their ivory towers that what Trump is doing is bad, and that these numbers are going to be inflated, that these numbers are going to be cooked in a way to make the economy look better than it is. Unlike those on the political left, I have no problem calling out both sides. When Joe Biden and the Democrats do it, it's bad. If Trump, which we don't know because it hasn't happened yet, of course, this is all wish casting, gaslighting, and virtue signaling. If the Trump pick for BLS in E.J. Anton is doing the same thing, that is also a problem, and I will have no issue sitting here on this show calling it out. I have some semblance of accountability on both sides of the political aisle. The left has zero. I am willing to call people out, call groups out, call individuals out, even when I agree with them politically, if it's something that doesn't make sense. And so when I see Democrats clutching their pearls over this stuff, I don't care. I have absolutely no sympathy for those writing these articles and pretending to care about these statistics out of BLS after what they watched unfold in front of their very eyes. This data wasn't hidden. This was not a whistleblower report. These are publicly available numbers month after month after month from BLS. And they said nothing. Maybe a little footnote at the bottom of the article. Oh, hey, the September jobs report was revised by, 200,000 jobs, meaning that they only created 100,000. Yeah, buried all the way down in their article. No outrage. No calls for Biden to fire the head of BLS with a 40% error rate. I guess that's normal for government. That's normal for those on the political left. It's okay to be wrong 40% of the time. That's totally acceptable for them. So as this article goes on, it says, Trump's nomination, an economist at the Right Wing Heritage Foundation, the think tank behind the Project 2025 blueprint for Trump's second term to the BLS job on Monday. The pick came less than 2 weeks after Trump fired Erica McEntifer and claimed, without citing any evidence, that she had rigged the July jobs report and showed the labor market to be weaker than thought. Trump said at the time of his new appointment he needs somebody to be approved by the United States Senate that would, quote, ensure that the numbers are being released are honest and accurate. However, according to the Financial Times, even economists on the political right doubt that a man they characterize as an inexperienced stooge of the president will fulfill the mission. So So they are finding random Republicans to bash the Trump administration, finding random Republicans, so-called Republicans, to bash the pick for BLS, who, by the way, is an economist, has a PhD in dealing with economics. So, I mean, you can claim that he doesn't have the experience. Sure, maybe. I don't think that's accurate. But you're acting like Trump just picked some random ass guy off the street and promoted him to the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He is a PhD economist. So I would say that he's got some level of experience and some level of expertise dealing with economics, dealing with data, and dealing with numbers. I mean, it's built into his title. But because he was from the Heritage Foundation, which, of course, you and I know is a very well-run, very important group on the political right that does an incredible amount of great work. But because he's from the Heritage Foundation, well, he can't possibly report anything accurately. He can't possibly do anything at all. Noting that he's not, this is directly a quote from the article, he is not a credible economist, and he is not going to do a good job at all. Huh. Okay. So we cared about it now. Or excuse me, we do care about it now. We care about those numbers being inaccurate now, potentially. Again, hasn't happened yet. We care about it now. We didn't care about it in the past. This is yet another example of Democrat virtue signaling on things that they didn't care about in the past. Like, you know, I don't know, the Epstein files. We throw that in there as another example. Things that now they proclaim they care so much about. Yet they shielded themselves, turned a blind eye, and said nothing or did nothing when these problems were happening under their own control. Democrats profess so much now to care about and claim they care about immigration so much, yet it was a disaster under their watch. They claim they now care about the economy, yet under their watch, inflation was at 9.2% in the summer of 2022. The American consumer is getting squeezed beyond belief. Nothing to say. Oh, it's an international issue. COVID. Not Joe Biden's fault. Not the Democrats' tax and spend policy fault. No, no, no. It's got to be somebody else's. And the list goes on and on and on. So until we have proof and until we have evidence of the Bureau of Labor Statistics under this new leadership cooking the books, purposely producing inaccurate data, which we will find out because it is publicly available, until that happens, I am not putting any stock or any credibility in any of these reports. Again, the hypocrisy is unimaginable. And while it hasn't even happened yet, and there's no indication that it's going to happen, it's already yet another situation of the sky is falling. Again, the headline of this article is all you need. The world is not going to trust our data. Well, did the world trust the data under the Biden administration that was had an error rate of 40%? I mean, when the Biden administration's BLS reported more than 1.1 million additional jobs that were actually not created over that span of a 12-month period of time last year, was there any conversation about that? Why would the world trust our data then? But now they can't? So you can trust the 40% error rate. You can trust the second largest job revision report in the history of BLS. You can trust that data. But because Trump picked a PhD economist from the Heritage Foundation to lead BLS, now the data can't be trusted. Go pound sand. This amount of outrage is something that I have absolutely no tolerance for. You guys watched this unfold under your very own eyes. You saw the reports month after month, year after year under the previous administration and didn't say a damn word. You didn't care. It showed a good economy. You do well, those on the political left, of course, those in the media, one and the same, will do anything in their power to make Democrats look better than the situation that's actually at hand. They are consistently doing that over and over again. And now the data can't be trusted. The sky is falling. BLS data is going to be manipulated by a Trump right-wing loyalist. But don't look over here. Ignore the jobs reports under the Biden administration. Ignore the almost 40% error rate under the Biden administration. That data was rock solid. But this guy is going to do a terrible job. Give me a freaking break. Yet another example of left-wing hypocrisy and left-wing media bias when it comes to issues reporting on Donald Trump. We see it literally every day. We talk about it a couple of times a week, and here's your most recent example. I'll throw the links to all of this. You can read through it yourself. You can read through the statistics from BLS yourself. Don't take my word for it if you don't believe me. I'll have all of that over on our Patreon coming up a little bit later on this morning. For those that support the show financially, $5, $10 a month, you can get access to those daily show notes and our monthly hangout over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. If you believe that you are getting some value from the program and enjoying the show here weekday mornings at 7 a.m., I'd encourage you to head on over to patreon.com/Nick Craig. Well, all eyes will be on the United States tomorrow, Alaska, as President Donald Trump is set to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin to try and put to end a 3-year war that started under the Biden administration. We'll have a full preview of that meeting coming up tomorrow morning right here on the Nick Craig Show. Thanks to the Law Group for their continued support. You can visit them online at lawgroupnc.com or give them a call at 910-251-6088. That's going to do it for a Thursday edition. Thanks for joining us live 7 a.m. on YouTube, Rumble X, and Facebook, or 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts.